Mr. Smith, Reel 2. Now, I know you want to say something about your mother's efforts to preserve what she could of your health
after
this polio stroke.
Well, she did a wonderful job, but there's no question. She was my nurse and my doctor and my physiotherapist and everything else. And she kept me alive, and she got me somehow going round. And it was going to be a long, long time before we got back to anywhere else where I could get any medical attention. And I've always said if medals were given out to wives and mothers for courage in such appalling condition, then nothing less than the Victoria Cross would be good enough for my mum. The trouble is that there's very little data to ascertain when the battalion actually returned from Nowshera, but it must have been just as hazardous going back as it was getting there. Some records show that the 2nd Battalion was there till 1937, but unfortunately it's not possible to determine exactly when the families returned, whether they returned in 37 or earlier, I don't know. A recent document that my brother Les has found of my father's service record shows the possibility that our family, may have come back early, earlier than the main battalion, and that we returned for England for a short while before going to rejoining the battalion in Malta. My mother always told me that when we returned, she was taken off the ship by stretcher before any others, which would indicate that she was with the rest of the contingent, and allowed to disembark because she was due to have an operation, and then she was nursing me. And she always told us the joke that she was teased unmercifully because going out, she was the first on the ship because she was nursing me at 6 weeks old. And that was something that they always teased her about. But whether or not we came home early or didn't come home early, I was at last to receive medical attention in Mayor Treloar's Orthopaedic Hospital in Alton, Hampshire.
So this is after the battalion came back from Malta.
Yeah.
You don't remember Malta
at all? I was always told by my mum that we were in India for 4 years and Malta for 2 years. And then Les seems to think that that wasn't quite true. So, I mean, but it's not something...
And you don't remember Malta, so...
I remember Malta vaguely. Vague. I've got vague visions of Malta because by then I was a little bit older. And, of course, by then, we got this magical thing called a box brownie camera, which we didn't have in India. So I've seen some of the films, the pictures of the family there.
So when do you think you went into this orthopaedic hospital at Alton? Would that be in 39 or 37?
Oh, it must have been 37. Must have been 37. Which means that I would be 4 or 5 years old, I think, you know. And I was there, according to what Mum told me, for 12 months.
And this is the Mayor Treloar's
Orthopaedic Hospital in Hampshire, and which at this moment is being pulled down.
And you'd be about four then?
About four, yeah.
Have some vague memories from the looks of this, of that. And four is, people are pretty conscious around then.
Yeah.
What do you remember of your medical treatment there and how you felt you were treated?
The things I remember, of course, are probably the things that weren't very pleasant. I remember being strapped on my back completely all the time I was there. This was the treatment that they then used for polio or infantile paralysis. The idea being was to keep you completely immobile. And I also remember having heat treatment. Now, this was looked like a bit of a homemade arc of wooden arc with loads of dozens of bulbs, electric light bulbs, which provided the heat. And that would be put over my legs for quite a time. Mum and Dad must have been 200 miles away at that time, in Halifax, so there was no way that they would have been able to visit me. In fact, nobody can remember coming to visit me in that period of time, because no such thing as jumping in a car or on a train to travel 200 miles. But down the road, 25 miles away, was Gosport, my mum's hometown. And, of course, there was my aunties and uncles and so forth. And I can't remember, but I assumed that I got the occasional visit from them, although 25 miles was a long time, long distance in those days. But the most striking thing that has stuck in my mind for some reason is the visit that I had from my mother's youngest brother, Uncle Roy. And it must have been about Christmas time, because I can remember that the nurses were putting up, I can remember this vividly, the nurses were putting up the decorations, and Uncle Roy volunteered to help. And I can see him now. In those days, they didn't have fancy ladders and what have you to get to the heights. They used these big A-frames. And I can see him now in his uniform, his Royal Marines uniform, at the top of this A-frame, putting up a large cracker, which it might not have been quite as large as it appears in my mind, but it was a large cracker. And Uncle Roy was Mum's favourite. And sadly, in May 1941, came the news that he'd been lost on HMS Hood, which was sunk in the Atlantic, as you know. And this devastated my mother. And she didn't get over it for the rest of her life. But the double tragedy event of that is amazing. In the First World War, when she was much younger, she had another youngest brother, age 15, Uncle Cyril.
What was his surname?
Tawney, T-A-W-N-E-Y. And he went down in the Battle of Jutland.
Which ship, do you remember?
I don't know. I can find out for you. Battle of Jutland. And at the same time, two of his brothers were on two other ships. I've been told one before it in convoy, one behind it, stood and watched.
Now, how appropriate would you say the treatment you got, this, you know, the heat treatment, the immobility and the massages that your nurses, I don't know whether you mentioned, but you've got them still from the nurses.
Yeah.
How appropriate was that?
Well, it wasn't appropriate. I mean, they were thrashing around in the dark, I think, on polio, because I don't think they knew much about how it came about and what it was all about. But I can remember being confronted with the treatments that they had in those days. And the first thing was this being strapped on your back completely and not being allowed to sit up. It's a physiotherapist's nightmare when I tell them that today, that somebody will be immobile to that degree, and it probably has left damage. I've got a very stiff spine, and that probably could be that. And then, of course, I was then being fitted out with the dreadful calipers for the first time. I mean, assume I didn't have any calipers in India.
Could you just briefly say what calipers are? I know what calipers are, and people of our age, but they're not so common now.
No, right. Well, a caliper basically is a metal, in those days, wrought iron metal device to strap round your leg to help to strengthen the leg. And the caliper, the daytime caliper that I wore, was basically wrought iron, half-inch wrought iron rods either side of the leg with straps around the top, thighs, knees, ankles and so forth. And basically you were walking around as though you were in a suit of armour. But the drawback to that was that the weight was such, and bearing in mind that this weight was going on a very weak leg, meant that you were dragging it round like Quasimodo, you know. And so whilst it sounded all right in those days, it was really terrible. And I don't say that with disrespect, because it's now recognised that they were terrible things and they served no purpose whatsoever, but that was all they thought up at the time. At night time, I had what was named by my brothers, my Tin Lizzie. Now, the Tin Lizzie can only be described as a device that I wore in bed to keep my legs straight and still. And it was like a half-round piece of guttering in aluminium or steel or something like that. The full length of the leg. And at the feet end, there was a straight wooden piece to hold the foot up straight because there was no strength to hold it there. And then on the back of this guttering, there were two wooden flat pieces to stop the leg rolling over sideways. So the idea was to keep it immobile, straight and upright. But the funny part and the funny side to all this is it was nicknamed My Tin Lizzy because whilst that was the idea of being in bed with this on, was to keep you sing, you inevitably moved. Now, in a family of four lads, five lads that we were going to be, family of four lads and visitors and whatever, very often, of course, someone had to share my bed. And this was dreaded. Because in the middle of the night, I would roll over and the whole contraption would go up in the air, just like a double-handed sword. And anybody that just happened to be in the way would be almost chopped to pieces. But it didn't serve the purpose. Nowadays, of course, whilst I don't receive treatment for polio, but nowadays they would never treat polio in those days. Do you want me to mention PPS, late effects?
No, we'll come back to that. Can we tidy that up?
Yeah.
You were in the hospital about a year, 37 to 38.
Yeah.
Not quite sure.
Not sure.
Where did you go when you came out? Did you a bit?
To Sawby Bridge in Yorkshire. Now, this is near Halifax. And we lived in a drill hall. This is all mentioned here, actually. We eventually, this is 38, 39-ish, we all finished up in the caretaker's quarters, if you like, of a drill hall.
What were they like, the quarters?
I suppose the day standards were awful, but in those days, compared to barracks, the awful barracks that we stayed in, they were quite good. But the main thing for us lads was the simple fact that we had our own indoor leisure park in the drill hall. We played in that, and we played all the games in that, and we had the run of the rifle range underneath. And occasionally, of course, I was allowed to shoot when I got a bit old, and Mum and Dad were good shooters, good rifle people, and the lads were. But the funniest thing I remember, and something that sticks in your mind as it does when you're kids, was that we had an enormous downpour of snow one year, and when it melted, it flooded the underground rifle range. And so we got one of the old wooden vaulting horses and turned it over, and that was our boat, and that was our own personal boating lake. But these are the things you remember.
Now, what was your dad doing there? This wasn't the battalion weren't there. What was he?
Well, we were getting very, very close to war. And he was transferred from the Dukes to the Royal Artillery. And he was also promoted to second lieutenant. Where we lived, which was on the Burnley Halifax Road, which is at the top of the hill overlooking Sawby Bridge, we lived in this drill hall. But the school, the only school I could have gone to, was at the bottom of the hill. And I've always realised that one of the reasons I didn't go to school immediately was that I couldn't manage to walk up and down this hill. There were no buses and so forth. Taxis out of the question. I couldn't walk up and down. My mother certainly couldn't carry me up and down. So I didn't actually go to school till I was eight.
Were you educated at home at all?
I must have had some education because I basically could read. And I think this is down to Mum. But one of the things, of course, in the nomadic life that we led was that I can never remember seeing books. And when I brought that up as time went on as to why it was I didn't see these books that other people used to have, encyclopedias and dictionaries and Bibles and that sort of thing. I was always told that, of course, in the nomadic way that we lived, we couldn't take everything with us. And books were one of those things that could be left behind and were left behind. So books were something that I never saw very much of. How Les went on and Sid went on, I don't know.
So you started your education in 1941.
Oh, I started, and I can specifically point that, because I know that I hadn't started school when the news of Uncle Roy being killed came through. Now, that was May 1941. What happened was we moved then down the hill, as it were, to a street very close and almost next door to the school. And I think part of that was to get me to school. And that would have been no earlier than 1941. So I would have been 8 years old before I started school, which in itself has always been a drawback. I've always been playing catch-up, you know.
Tell me about that. How did you do at school?
Well, at 8 years old, I'd only got 2 or 3 years to go before you then went to the more senior schools. I've always had a very good IQ. I've always been told by various people that I've got a high IQ. So that would have helped. And in the what they call the universe of the world, you know, you would have picked up all this, that and the other. But when it came to going to grammar school, as it was, I was paid for. My mother somehow scraped the money together to pay for me to go to grammar school. And I think that was, again, her stepping in and trying to make up for the loss of education. I did fairly well at grammar school, but not brilliant, because I just hadn't got the background. Things like spelling and writing and, you know, all the basics that I'd missed were missing. And, of course, that always led me into all sorts of conflicts. But one of the strange things was this, that I always came top in one subject, algebra. And the reason for that was that we always worked out the algebraic equations on the blackboard, which meant I didn't have to put it down in writing. And I can recall now my teacher saying, well, it's marvellous, you can stand there and work these things out in your head on the blackboard whilst I'm writing there, but you can't put the blessed things down in writing. And this is, I suppose, how the body copes with the thing. The IQ that I've always had, and it has been clarified by the professionals, as they say, I've got a very high IQ, has stood me in good stead. And I think that comes from a number of things. The family, generally speaking, from father downwards, very intelligent people. And none of us were sort of thick or are thick. And I think that's something that came along.
Now, while you were at school, how were you treated? And I know you've got something to say about this. And how did you respond in the fact that you were, you were disadvantaged by a bad leg?
Well, in those days, of course, there wasn't the political clout that there is now with disabled people. And we weren't called disabled, we were called cripples. And, of course, that was a polite word. And I came in for my fairest amount of bullying, peg leg and what have you. And the advantage I did have was that I'd been brought up with four brothers, who all four of them could look after themselves. And I too could look after myself, if I could catch them. So I never could, you know, I had to devise means and ways of catching these so-and-sos that called me. And I would stand at the school gates and things like that, and they had to go past me. Then I'd grab them and belt them. So, but in those days, I fought like hell, even at that young age, for my rights. And I can recall having stand-up rows with people, stand-up rows with teachers, about the fact that I had a right to go on the football field. I had a right to go on the cricket pitch. I had a right to play tennis. I had a right to swim. And I got punished severely by some of the teachers. Physically sometimes, they would set about me. Really punched the living daylights out of me. But there was a heavyweight boxer that was at the back of this period, and that was my mother. Having had four lads and being a tough old bird herself, she had a right hand that even Muhammad Ali would would avoid. And she was quite willing and quite often would roll her sleeves up and go up to the school and get hold of these teachers and say, right, you're going to thump anybody, thump me. Quite no doubt about that whatsoever. And they were in fear of her. But she'd worked too hard. She'd worked too hard. It was hurting her just as much as it hurt me. And as time goes on, of course, things start to get better for disabled people. But if I'd been, I'd go at anything. I'd have a go at cricket, I'd have a go at football later on. I had a go at judo. And I was renowned as being very good mat fodder, which meant that I could be thrown very easily. And one of the poignant things that was built into me, I never... If I came across a problem, I faced it and got round it somehow. And all my brothers, as time went on, went into the services. Les joined during the war. Sid joined as soon as he could. Don went into the boy soldier to Arbor Field. Colin, the youngest one, went into the Marines. When it came to my turn, in about 1950, there was no way I could go into the services.
I'll come to that. I'd like to ask how the war affected your family. I mean, what was your father doing during the war?
Well, we hardly saw him.
He serving?
He served in Norway. He served on the continent. He served all over, but in those days you didn't know where he was. He was in the initial stages of the invasion of Norway and the evacuation of Norway, I understand. Les has done a lot of research on this, and Don particularly, who, of course, unfortunately, now is in a nursing home, has done an awful lot.
Did you worry about your dad?
I can't recall being overly worried, because I think throughout our lives he'd always gone off fighting somewhere. Through my life, anyway. Gone off fighting somewhere. And so you always had that feeling, I suppose, he'd come back. You know, he'd go off. And one thing he will never do, though, is talk about the war. He never would sit down and talk about the war. He used to say to me, you don't want to know. And when I read of various things, like the thing I've just said about Roy and Cyril, you should want to know. People should remember those things. Les says quite a bit, because of course he was from 41 to the end of the war in the Navy.
We'll hopefully see him. Did you follow what was going on in the war? Did you take an interest
in
it?
Yes. I mean, we went to the Tupney Flicks, as they used to call it, the picture house. We had the radio and we listened to all these things. You don't get it as immediate as you do now, of course. But, I mean, I've been thrown out of many cinemas when when troops were marching down and I used to whistle, like all the kids down, you know, and they used to throw you out for doing it. But yes, very interesting. Even though I couldn't go in myself. I've always been a military man at heart. And when it came to my turn to go in...
Hang on, still a bit far ahead. When did you leave school? Did you leave school before the end of the war?
Yeah, I left at 14, 15.
So that's after the war?
After the war, yeah.
Well, do you remember the end of the war?
Yes, I mean, I remember VE, VJ Day, and when we had big bonfires on the wreck, as they used to say, and we chopped up all the seats in the air raid shelter to feed it. Got told off for it, but it was an air raid shelter that we didn't need. That's the air raid shelter on the wreck, of course, in Salisbury Bridge. I remember that, you know, and remember seeing Les coming home. Les coming up the street with his kit bag. It was unbelievable. And of course, you never knew. You never knew. You very rarely knew he was coming. And I would look out of the door or something like that and go running. He said, Les is coming up the street. And he would say, don't be so bloody silly. You know, he's in Singapore or something like that. And there would be Les. And Les would have bananas and things like that, you know, that we'd never seen. Tremendous. And the first thing Les always used to do is treat you to something. He'd take me downtown and buy me a toy and things like that. A lot of love between brothers. Even though we're spread out, a lot of love between the brothers, and they're still there.
What about things like the effects of rationing and just, you know, generally during the war? Did that affect you much, or did you see any of the...
I don't think we suffered. I can't remember starving, that's certain. And I suppose really this is down to Mum and how she could make a tin of corned beef last 6 months and that sort of thing. But, you know, she was a very good basic cook, and you know, I can't remember starving.
And for clothes, you wore cast-offs still, did you? Or
yes, there was quite a lot of cast-offs floating around. Quite a lot of cast-offs. And Mum, of course, she's very good at repairing and patching and, you know, that sort of thing.
And any air raids in the area?
No, very few. At Sobby Bridge. We did have some evacuees. We had some cousins that came up from Gosport as evacuees.
And how did you treat them?
I mean, well, they were cousins. They were cousins. So, I mean, they were treated like parts of the family. But we did have one cousin, one evacuee called... Oh, dear.
Doesn't matter too much. Yeah. Well, how did they fit in?
I don't think they were not... My mother would take anybody in and treat anybody as one of her sons. There's no doubt about it. I think evacuees generally were treated as pretty poorly. Tommy Edwards. Brighton.
Did they stay long?
2 or 3 years. 2 or 3 years. Yeah, yeah.
So they went to school.
Yeah. One thing I can remember during the war, which Mum always took us on holiday from Sorby Bridge to Gosport. We went down, I think, every year. And she would take the whole family of us on a 12-hour train journey, which was loaded with troops, and particularly when you got nearer to Gosport, to Portsmouth. And she would take us down there, and oh, that was tremendous to go down there. And we saw air raids down there when we were in Gosport. I can remember seeing planes being shot down. You know. And of course, we heard all the stories from all our uncles that were in the Navy and what have you, and it really thrilled you, you know. I would have loved to have gone in to the services, and one of the regrets I've always had is not being able to go into the services and join in, see that camaraderie at first hand, and sharing all this danger, I suppose, as well as the night that obviously, then I can read and see it, watch films now to the early hours of the morning.
Now, when the war finished, you were still at school. You were 12, basically, yep. And you stayed till 14 or 16.
I was there till about 14. And then I came out.
About work? How did you?
Well, I had a variety of jobs initially. I became an apprentice, a joiner. Until they realised that they got an apprentice joiner on top of roofs, high buildings, with a gammy leg. That was the co-op, and then they transferred me to the grocery department. And then Dad, by then, had gone on to the TA side in Derby. So we then moved to Derby, which was a whole new ball game as far as I was concerned. It was a new life, you know. For my part in Derby,
So you went to Derby in the what? 49.
And they then became very interested in religion. I became religious, and I married eventually a very lovely girl. I've been married now for 40 odd years. I got a lovely daughter.
So what work did you do when you got to Derby?
Upholsterer. Apprentice upholsterer.
And did you find your disability, you know, if you accepted as that, did you find it a problem to you as an upholsterer?
No. I never allowed it to be a problem. Never allowed it to be a problem at all.